Welcome back to Stacktrace, the podcast where we talk about Apple news and rumors from a developer's perspective. My name is John Sandell.
And I'm Guy Rambo.
All right, it's a big, busy week and we have lots of things to talk about.
Yeah, I've been doing some beta testing and lots of development this week. I had already finished the Apple Pay stuff last week, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I was working very hard over the holidays to release Apple Pay, which is now available in Brazil, and I can't wait to get my card. My card is not here yet, so I can't use Apple Pay.
I love Apple Pay. It's such a fantastic, almost magical technology. when you have Apple Pay, especially when you're in a situation like when I was skiing this winter, and I could just go in the slope and like go up to a vendor and buy some goulash and then just pay with my watch. It was just, it's almost like living in a science fiction movie.
That's badass payment method. Cool.
That totally is. All right, we should start with some follow-up. We talked 2 weeks ago about the fact that Apple might be designing their own CPUs for their computers. And we kind of made the assumption when we were talking about it that those would be ARM. They would use the ARM architecture. But we had some comments on Twitter that, you know, it might also be x86. So what do you think about that? Like, could it potentially be x86, these new hypothetical chips that they might be working on?
Yeah, so someone by the name of Wardrip on Twitter, he said something like, what if Apple built processors using x86 and not ARM? And yeah, that's definitely a possibility. But as I think we talked about not during the show, it's kind of like counterintuitive because Apple is currently only making ARM processors. They have all of that expertise in managing ARM processor architecture and developing really efficient processors using that architecture. It would be a lot more work for them to actually do x86 processors.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Intel has their flaws, but they are generally very, very good at making x86 processors. So sure, I'm sure Apple could, with lots of effort, make something that's, you know, equivalent or better, but it seems like kind of far ahead, or it seems like that would be an insane amount of work. And if you compare that to doing it on ARM, where, you know, they already have these really advanced, fast A series of chips, and kind of, you can kind of more, it seems like it's more likely that they could port that to work in a bigger machine, like in a computer, than actually building their own x86-based chips.
Yeah, and we're probably going to talk more about this in the Mac Pro section, but I would expect the initial Macs with ARM chips to be like the least powerful ones, like the 12-inch MacBook. I wouldn't expect them to like go and do the Mac Pro as the first ARM Mac. That doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, that would be pretty crazy. And also, you know, one of the biggest benefits of ARM is the power efficiency. And you could kind of imagine like a low power, you know, in the 12-inch MacBook, like being very low power and low performance also, but just having this insane amount of battery life like we talked about last episode, which would be, you know, really fantastic in a product like that.
Yeah, and there are other advantages of Apple making their own chips, like they can develop customized processing units inside those chips that are like optimized for specific tasks, like a video encoder that's optimized to HEVC and a neural engine that can process like facial data. So that's the kind of stuff that they can do when they make their own processors that's like all made around ARM processors, and they would have to develop something for x86. So I think ARM is the way to go for them.
Yeah, it definitely looks like it. You've also been busy beta testing. You've been working with the Schoolwork app and ClassKit.
Yeah, so when Apple had their educational event, they officially announced ClassKit and Schoolwork, which are two pieces of this new system of activities for students and teachers. And we knew about them because some blogger, I don't know if you know this blogger, posted something mentioning that iOS had a new framework called ClassKit.
I wonder who it could be.
And the name of the app was Classwork, but then they decided to name it Schoolwork, which I think is a better name.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So when they released the initial documentation, they asked us to fill in a form asking for access to the ClassKit resources. And then I think it was yesterday or the day before when we were recording that they sent me a test flight invitation for Schoolwork and more detailed documentation for ClassKit, and I'm having some fun with them. I've used the Schoolwork app a little bit, and it's really nice. It's a nice design. It reminds me a little bit of the Playgrounds app, like the way the UI looks, especially if you compare it with the Swift Playgrounds kind of store that they have in the app.
Right.
So the teacher can create assignments and can assign them to specific students or to a whole class. And the way we test it is by using this special development environment that includes both a teacher and a student, and you can switch in settings whether you are a teacher or a student.
Ah, okay.
That's something that's not common for Apple to do, which is to make it easy for us to test stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
They have like the sandbox environment for in-app purchases, which is known for being terrible. But this one is kind of nice and it's very easy to use. And yeah, so I'm enjoying it. And I think teachers that are on like schools that use all of this Apple stuff will be very happy when it comes out.
Nice. Yeah, sounds good. So basically when you're working with it, you will go in and you will say like, now I'm a teacher, and you will assign some task to yourself as a student. And then you could just go to settings, switch to kind of the student's version, and then you can go in and actually perform those tasks.
Yeah, so you can play the role of both the teacher and the student, and you alternate between them. So you make sure that the experience in both your app and Schoolwork is good for both the student and the teacher.
Nice. Well, that sounds very good. And have you had some time to play around with ClassKit as well and to integrate it with your app?
Not too much yet. I'm just getting started with that, but I played around with the Schoolwork app just to get a feel of how the entire system works. And one thing that I found interesting is that you can actually assign apps that don't have ClassKit integration. So you can say like, go into like YouTube and watch this video, and so you can link something, and the student can. The difference is that the student will then have to manually mark that activity as completed. Doesn't have all of the nice integration and automatic stuff. And another cool thing is that apps can define custom properties to activities. Like if you're doing a quiz, you can like tell the ClassKit system that the user has like gotten like 3 answers correct and 2 wrong, and that the user has used the hints 3 times, for instance. It's a really nice system, very flexible.
Oh, that's pretty cool. And that, like, you register that as some form of metadata or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just like key value stuff.
Okay, nice. In classic Apple fashion, mm-hmm. dictionaries everywhere.
The main issue I have with the API itself is that they use the word context everywhere.
Yeah.
And I kind of have a problem with that word in APIs.
really?
Yeah, it's like you get a CLS store and you get the shared instance, which is a singleton, another thing Apple loves. And then you get the main app context. So, and what is that? Like, it's the main app context. What does that mean? You could easily replace that by main app doodad. And like, it doesn't mean anything. So I have a problem with the usage of context, but hey, it's their API.
Yeah, it's a little bit ambiguous, right? It would maybe make more sense to call it, like, I know there's also something else like activity, but, you know, to try to find a better mapping, because when you call something context, it automatically kind of becomes very kind of general purpose.
Yeah, and they have, like, the job they had wasn't easy. You have to develop this hierarchical API that can associate with content in different types of apps, and you have to make it as flexible as possible. So it's not an easy task, and I think they did a good job there.
Yeah, that sounds good. And the last piece of follow-up is that we've had several people ask us since we launched this show if we are going to also launch some form of Patreon to actually, you know, enable people to support us and support our work. And this is something that we're definitely considering. We're thinking about it because our main goal with the show, like we've already kind of stated, is that we want to start doing this weekly. We think that, you know, a new show like this one could really, really benefit from being a weekly thing because, you know, the news happened and we want to discuss it as quickly as possible when it's like still really relevant. But of course, like doing this kind of weekly commitment is kind of a big thing. So if we were to do that, we definitely need some kind of way to support our work. But whether that's going to be Patreon or something else, we don't really know yet. But we really appreciate everyone who has kind of, you know, asked us about it and showed this interest. And we're definitely thinking about it.
Yeah, we're still thinking about how we can make this podcast a weekly show. And we're also considering other options. So stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned for more info about that. And, you know, we also want to thank everyone who has kind of, you know, helped spread the show and shared it with people, and also people who send us feedback and, you know, tell us that, you know, we want this to happen weekly. You know, seeing those kind of tweets and getting those emails, it's very, very motivating. So, you know, keep it up, and we really appreciate everyone who has supported us so far.
So, John, there's been an Apple leak today.
There has been.
Yeah, you know, there's you won't guess what the leak was about.
No, what was the leak about? Tell me.
The leak was about leaks.
Oh my god, that's so meta.
That's the leak of leaks.
Does it get any more leaky than that?
No, it's like a fire hose.
So very, very funny story coming out of Bloomberg from Mark Gurman that Apple apparently has been sending out a memo that has been leaked about trying to stop employees from leaking.
Yeah, precisely. And this is not the first time that it happens. I remember they held like a company-wide meeting. I think it was last year, talking specifically about leaks, and someone recorded and leaked the audio from the meeting. So yeah, they have a problem with leaks. And so this memo is very interesting because it actually cites specific occurrences, and they mention a certain blogger at a certain website. They mentioned that just before last September special event, an employee leaked a link to the Gold Master of iOS 11 to the press, believing he wouldn't be caught. And the entire tone of this memo seems to be that, one, if you leak, you're going to get caught, and two, that leaks really hurt Apple. I think that's what they're trying to express through this memo. What do you think?
Yeah, and this is a narrative they've been using, you know, for quite a while, that, you know, they want to control the story, they want to control how the product is presented to the general public, and that if a leak happens, it can also hurt sales of current products because, well, if you know that a new iPhone is around the corner, you might not go out and buy the current generation iPhone. And, you know, all of these arguments kind of have merit, but at the same time, we're seeing Apple, like, making record profits, you know, month after month, quarter after quarter. So, and even though there has been quite a lot of leaks lately. So it's kind of hard to tell, you know, how much of these arguments are actually anchored in reality. But I also, you know, I get it. Like, I get it that, you know, Apple is a company. They put on these big shows, these, you know, really, really good press events where they have all these, you know, awesome videos and Johnny Ive talking in the White Room and all these things. And they want that to be the message. They don't want, you know, to have some kind of low resolution photo of an iPhone being shown on the internet. They want to control the message themselves.
For me, the argument that makes most sense is that one, that they want to control the narrative. And I think they are correct in some way. Like, I don't think it completely ruins the launch. But yeah, it makes sense for them to want to control how they are going to talk about the brand new features. Like with last year especially, the all of the Face ID stuff that leaked months before the release, those were like complicated because you're talking about a brand new feature. And even before you announce this new phone with this feature, people are already like speculating about how it's going to be good or not. So it makes sense for them to want to control the narrative behind new releases.
Yeah, and speaking of control, I mean, sometimes we've also heard that Apple are actually leaking things to the press themselves. Like, for example, when the iPhone 7 was going to get rid of the headphone jack, there was these like many kind of reports or speculations that that was actually leaked ahead of time by Apple to set the right expectations so that the phone wouldn't be announced and then all the reviews would just complain about the removal of the headphone jack.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, leaks are tricky because, you know, yeah, it's it can ruin the surprise a little bit. And but also it's, you know, it's so much fun to speculate. And, you know, even if like a small amount of information leaks, we generally don't have the full story. And just being able to kind of speculate about it and talk about it, I think it's a lot of fun and really interesting. But I totally get from Apple's perspective that it's something like really negative. The one thing that kind of set me back a little bit reading this memo was, you know, the tone is really harsh. And, you know, if I was an employee of Apple reading this, I would be, I would feel a little bit, I guess, uncomfortable, because I understand that they really want to stop people from leaking, but this is like, it's almost like threatening your employees, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, they even talk about like going to jail and stuff. And
yeah.
People sometimes ask me, why aren't you working at Apple or Google or Microsoft or any of those cool, quote-unquote, companies and big companies? And that's one of the many reasons why I'm not interested in working at one of those huge companies. Because even though I would never be the one doing this stuff, you can imagine, even if you're like a nice employee that never leaks anything, working in that kind of environment must be really stressful.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, you would rather have like an encouraging message than having something like, you know, you better watch out or we're going to send you to jail kind of thing. I mean, that's not what it says, but that's kind of the feeling you get from reading it.
Yeah, and what if like someone on your team leaks something and then like they interrogate everyone on the team? I have no idea if that happens, but let's say,
I mean,
that
they have
it happens.
Their own investigation squad. So yeah, probably
you get called to a room with a huge light on your face and like, what were you doing on the night of September 7th or something?
And yeah,
like that's not cool. You don't want to go through that.
No, you get put in the same room that they shoot these Johnny Ive videos in, this white room with no walls. It's just white.
The big Johnny Ive room, yeah.
Exactly. You don't want to go to the big Johnny Ive room. Yeah, so it's very funny that this, you know, because of course this ends up leaking. So yeah, it's a weird thing, and you know, we understand Apple's kind of feelings, but also it's strange to see something like this, which obviously wasn't meant to go public, but yeah, it kind of gives you an uneasy feeling about that kind of things. So, speaking of leaks, we actually have another Apple leak.
Oh.
And this time, we have a picture of what appears to be a gold version of the iPhone X. What yeah. great timing, huh?
So just to give people some context, we're recording this on the end of the day, Friday, and this story has just come out. We put this in the show notes before it went live on 9to5 Mac. We were discussing this internally at 9to5 when we started recording. So we are still not really sure whether this is like a new iPhone X model that's gold and that's going to be released, or whether this is like an iPhone X gold that was planned to be released last year, but they changed their mind or couldn't like make them in quantity. So keep that in mind. It might be just like an idea that never came to light.
Yeah, exactly. And I think also there was some documentation associated with it that mentioned like an LCD screen, and the iPhone X has an OLED screen. So that would either indicate, well, incorrect documentation, or maybe it's a new model, or like you say, maybe it's something they experimented with, because this all comes from an FCC filing. And I'm not an expert in these things by far, but as far as I know, this is something you have to file kind of well ahead of time, right?
Yeah, and I noticed the LCD thing, but what I thought about it is that maybe they like use LCD as just like a generic term for a cell phone screen, because I'm not an expert as well, but I don't think the display technology is very important to FCC. I think they're more worried about the radio transmissions and whether the device is injecting noise into the electrical system if you're charging it. I think that's where they are more focused on. So I don't think it would be a big deal for them to mention LCD when it's an OLED screen. But yeah, it's an interesting leak, and it's a pretty device, right? I like it.
Yeah, it's very nice. And it also kind of fits in with the colors of the other Apple products. You know, you usually have, you have silver, you have space gray, you have some form of gold, like rose gold or yellow gold. So yeah, we don't have a gold version of the iPhone X yet, so that could definitely be a possibility.
So another thing we speculated internally at 9to5 is that the flagship iPhone X was supposed to be gold. Like, that would be the main color they would...
Like, the edition.
Yeah, that would be, like, the iPhone X color, but for some reason they changed their mind. And mainly because of probably, like, production issues, that they wouldn't be able to manufacture all three colors. And gold is obviously not the main color. It's not the color most people want. But we think maybe in marketing they were planning on using the gold color as like the main color. And it would make sense, because doing some research on model numbers, I found in the car types subsystem on iOS, they have all of the models that we saw on that FCC document. And they have three UTIs for iPhone X. It's iPhone X, iPhone X 1, and iPhone X 2. And the only ones that actually exist are the iPhone X 1 and 2. So the iPhone X, the 0 one, is not in there. It's there, but the icon doesn't exist on the system. So maybe that first iPhone X was supposed to be the gold one that never came. So.
Oh. That's very interesting.
It would make sense for it to be like an unreleased product that's never going to be released. And I can imagine how much people are willing to pay for a prototype of one of those.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, it would make sense. I mean, gold, I can imagine, is like a difficult color to produce, you know, to get the materials right and with the right strength and all of that, all of those requirements, especially on a part which is, you know, the steel band around the phone like the iPhone X has.
Yeah. Have you seen the iPhone 8 Red, by the way?
I have seen that it was released, but I haven't seen it in the wild.
I've seen some videos, and it's really nice. Like, I wouldn't buy it because...
Yeah, it looks very nice.
It's red, and I don't want to have a red phone, but it's really beautiful.
Yeah, and this red series of products, is very nice that Apple is doing that in general because, you know, it's for a good cause. And also, it's like they have this striking appearance. Like you say, it's a very, very different design even when it's this like really bright red color, which looks really good on some devices, I think. Like, it looks really great on the watch bands. You know, the iPods were looking great in this bright red. But yeah, I wouldn't want my main phone to be bright red either.
Yeah, I was watching MKBHD's video about the new iPhone 8 Red, and I think he mentioned, like, I can't portray using my cameras how red this is. You have to see it in person. It's
super
really
red.
Super red.
Yeah. Yeah, so very interesting stuff, and I guess we'll have to wait and see if Apple is going to announce a new gold iPhone 10, or if this was just, like you say, like a scrapped product that never saw the light of day, or maybe it's something we're going to see in the future. So another thing that came out recently is that Matthew Panzerino from TechCrunch, he had an exclusive visit to Apple's offices to see the work that is being done on the new Mac Pro. And Apple seems to have taken things, you know, a little bit further with how they are designing this product. They have even hired people in-house to work on some pro workflows like video editing and 3D work and things like that to kind of influence the design decisions of the hardware itself, which I thought was really, really interesting. So what do you think when you hear these news about the Mac Pro? Does that make you excited about this product? Do you think that this is something that, you know, it's good that Apple is taking these steps and doing this?
I'm probably never gonna have a Mac Pro because it's not the device for me. I'm a laptop person, but I'm very happy that they're doing this. Many people are not. People are like complaining that it's only coming in 2019, and there's like this thing on the Apple circle that people like to say, like, I think this happened with iPhone 10 as well. Like, we didn't ask for this. Like, we didn't ask that Apple
right.
did this thing with like pros and stuff.
Or yeah, the new keyboard on the MacBook Pros is a good example as well.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you didn't, but guess what? They're doing it. It's their company.
Yeah.
But I think the result is going to be like a good one. I really believe that.
Yeah. I think this is a really, really cool direction. And I really love the fact that they're trying to, you know, really familiarize themselves with these type of workflows and with these problems. Because, you know, sometimes the risk when you're designing a product like this, you know, with really long lead times and they have to make decisions very early on. And, you know, the danger is that you design a product that people, you know, for workflows that don't really exist, or, you know, with trade-offs that kind of make it harder to work with. And this is something we've seen in some Pro products recently, like, for example, the latest Mac Pro, the quote-unquote trash can, right? Where Apple had this vision, like, oh, we're going to build this, you know, very, you know, beautiful, small little machine, which is going to be really, really focused on GPU power. And then we're going to use Thunderbolt for, you know, extensibility, and you're going to be able to plug in things. And, you know, none of these things that they envisioned kind of really happened or really took off in a mainstream way. So I really like the fact that they seem now to be way more focused on, like, okay, let's try to solve real life problems that people are facing right now.
And I bet many people that are complaining about this are people that a couple of years ago were saying, like, oh, this secrecy stuff doesn't work for pro hardware. Apple should listen to pros. And now they're complaining that Apple is doing this. You can
well,
never...
people always love to complain.
Yeah, you're never right.
Yeah, exactly. And people were disappointed that this is a 2019 product, but, you know, first of all, they never said that it was going to be a 2018 product. And, you know, for me, it's like, I think they should just take their time. I think they should take their time and build something really, really great instead of rushing something to market. because, you know, we don't want them to just, you know, slap some components in a box and call it a day. I mean, some people might be happy with that, but when Apple are at their best, this is when they make these kind of unexpected, really delightful, nice products that, you know, they don't only solve, you know, the current thing, but they also are future thinking, and they're also solving problems we might be facing, you know, in 2 years. And, you know, this is what I would love to see from a product like this, like a really, you know, super high-end, amazing, cool machine. And, you know, if they need another year to do that, then, you know, go ahead, take your time.
Yeah, that's another thing. Like, people complain that Apple releases unfinished stuff. So let them work.
Exactly. Let them work. And also, I mean, they just came out with the iMac Pro. So for people who are really, you know, in need of pro level hardware, I mean, by all accounts, the iMac Pro is like an amazing machine.
Oh, yeah, that's like an amazing machine. And one of the reasons they did this was probably so people know that the Mac Pro is only coming in 2019. So if they were like waiting, oh, I'm going to wait till like WWDC to buy an iMac Pro because they might release the Mac Pro at WWDC or announce it. Those people now, they know that if they really need a Pro machine for this year, they should go with iMac Pro.
Yeah, exactly. So I am really excited about the Mac Pro, actually. And for me, I'm thinking a lot about it and whether or not I would be interested in buying one. I'm sure it's going to be pretty expensive, you know, maybe even ridiculously expensive. But the fact that Apple has already said that this is going to be a modular system really, really excites me, because the idea of modularity in general is something that I find really appealing. Because I tend to work on many, many different things, and I tend to get interested in new things all the time. Like, you know, some months I might dive really, really deep into 3D rendering and working on 3D games, and I want to, you know, work with Unreal Engine and VR and these kind of things. And the next month I'm happy with just a text editor. So having like a modular system that I could upgrade without having to buy a completely new computer, just that idea is really, really appealing to me.
And what do we think about when we hear modular? What do you think? Like, you're going to be able to change the processor or something?
Yeah, I mean, the way it's been thought about in kind of the, in general sense, at least like up until now when it comes to computers, is that, you know, you build your own PC, for example, right? You can, like you say, you can change the processor, you can swap out the GPU, you can plug in more GPUs, you can change the... nothing is basically soldered. In the laptops that we have right now and in the iMac Pro, a lot of components, almost all of them, are actually soldered inside of the computer. Like, you can't upgrade anything, you can't change anything. And for me, a modular system is like the complete opposite of that, where, you know, whatever I want to change, I can just, you know, upgrade that and put that into the computer.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think one of the components that makes a lot of sense to be upgradable is the CPU itself. Have like a socket that, like, if next year Intel comes up with a brand new CPU that's compatible with the previous one and it's like 30% faster, you can just like buy the new CPU and stick it in there.
And you can choose what you are the most interested in, like what you want to spend your money on. Right now it's like, if I want a new GPU, well, I'm going to have to buy a completely new computer, which means that I'm also going to pay for a new CPU, a new hard drive, a new RAM, new everything. So what I love about a modular system is that I can more like design it to my needs. So if I want to stick in like, you know, 4 really powerful GPUs in order to do this like ray tracing real-time rendering that they were demoing at the Game Developers Conference this year, I could do that, hypothetically, right? And just even if I probably won't spend all that money to buy all these crazy GPUs, the idea that I can and the idea that I can change my mind, again, it's really appealing to me. And I just, that kind of design philosophy is something that I feel has been a little bit lost the last couple of years in the Apple ecosystem, in favor of these more, you know, just really opinionated, kind of just, you know, take it or leave it kind of products.
That goes for initial configuration as well. If you're like just a developer and you don't need super powerful GPUs, but you do need a decent CPU and 128 gigs of RAM to run Slack and Xcode at the same time, you can get just that. You don't have to get a really cool GPU just because that's the package.
Exactly. And, you know, you can be a developer right now working with Swift or whatever kind of development you're working on. But then in 2 years, you might get really into machine learning. And if you want to develop, you know, really high-end machine learning apps, you need a really powerful GPU. So then you could, you know, hypothetically just go to the store and buy one and plug it into your Mac Pro. I think maybe this is something that appeals to me as a programmer. You know, when we're designing systems, we like things to be modular and decoupled, and you can, you know, easily test things by mocking a certain part. And I feel like if my computer could work like that as well, that would just be beautiful.
Yeah, and the thing is, I love that stuff, but then people say, well, just go to Windows, just build your own PC. But then, like, my friends that do that, they spend more time troubleshooting their PC assembly than actually doing stuff. So
yeah,
that's not what I want to do. I want to have, like, the freedom to, like, configure my computer, but not have to be all troubleshooting it all the time. And but I'm probably not going to get a desktop in the near future. I don't know. It doesn't compute for me like having like a really cool and powerful desktop at home. But then when I go to the office or if I'm traveling, I only have my laptop. And I know I have this super powerful computer sitting at home, but I can't use it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so exactly.
I do go to the... I work remotely some days, and I go to the office. Like half my week I go to the office and the other half I work from home. And it's not because my company demands it. It's because I like going to the office and seeing people. But then I think, well, maybe if I had a super cool iMac Pro, I wouldn't be going to the office because I wouldn't want to use my weak quote-unquote laptop.
So exactly.
I have that dilemma.
Yeah, the question becomes, do you like your coworkers more than your iMac Pro?
Ooh, I hope they don't listen to this.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, for me, I work from home, so it would make a lot of sense for me to have a computer like this, but I also do a lot of traveling. But for me, I would actually like to have like the lightest computer possible when traveling, which is why I bought the 13-inch MacBook Pro without Touch Bar, because I wanted like a really light, portable machine for traveling. But then I would love to have like a really powerful machine when I'm at home as well. And, you know, for my current needs, when I'm not doing like really high-end 3D stuff, which I've kind of, you know, put aside for now, the 13-inch works perfectly for that. But yeah, I wouldn't say no to more processing power. I mean, who would, right? So the modularity aspect of this hypothetical Mac Pro really excites me. But the thing that also really excites me about that is the fact that Apple is making this. And Apple, they usually have this way of, you know, looking at something like modularity and saying, you know what, we could make this where you like, you have to screw in the GPU or the CPU, you know, manually, you have to connect the wires. But usually Apple doesn't want that kind of stuff. They want things to be elegant and nice. So imagine a modular system, but where you had these like, you know, really easy to use like slots where you could basically just like, you know, slot in a new GPU and you just click it in basically, and you don't even have to reboot your machine and it just all works. I think that could be really cool. And I'm not sure if that's what they're going for, if that's even going to be possible. But I'm just kind of, you know, dreaming about this like computer where, you know, Apple, they're taking things, you know, a step further in terms of like the customizability and the ease of use.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing what they come up with.
Awesome. So the next thing we want to talk about is a little bit about user privacy. So this has been a really hot topic lately. We've had some, you know, pretty big scandals coming out of companies like Facebook, and, you know, the fact that a company called Cambridge Analytica were able to like get a hold of a lot of information about a lot of people and using it to, you know, manipulate elections and all these crazy things. So just like last episode when we talked about education, we don't want to dive too much into like the political nature of it or these kind of things. We want to keep talking about like the technical side. But I think this is a really, really big thing that is happening right now where, you know, people are taking a little bit of a different look at user privacy, and the general public is starting to become more aware about kind of what it means, you know, for companies to collect their data and how that actually works. So what are your kind of overall thoughts about this, like about the fact that we have all these companies now and their business model is basically, you know, gathering as much data about you as possible and using that for advertisement or for selling it or something like that?
For many years, I had a bad feeling about anything I use online that I don't pay for or that doesn't have a very clear business model, where I basically the question I want answered always is, how are these people making money?
Yeah.
So as an example, the recent release of Cloudflare's DNS, the 1.1.1.1 DNS, which
that
came
they
out
announced on April 1.
Yeah, precisely. So they answered that question very quickly, that they want people to use their DNS because it's going to perform better with their CDNs, and they sell CDN service to enterprise, and that's how they're going to make money, and that's why they're offering their DNS for free. So that's their model, and it's pretty clear how they're making money, and it's not from the users themselves or by collecting and selling data. So that's one point. I've always been very careful about that. And when I started using Apple stuff, I didn't start because of this, but I'm very happy I like Apple stuff because they seem to be one of the very few companies, like big companies, that actually care about privacy, even going as far as saying that privacy is a basic human right, which I agree. And so I'm really happy that I use their stuff and I'm happy with their stuff because I basically can't be a heavy user of like Google's stuff because of the way they handle user data.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's been this classic saying lately has been, you know, if you're not paying for the service, then you are the product, right? Like the company is monetizing you.
Yeah, that's a classic one. And it's true. Mark, he mentioned that it's not true, but he's wrong. he tried to make the case for why it's not true, but it is. Unfortunately, if you're not paying, there's a good chance that the product is yourself. And you're actually paying, but you're not paying with money. You're paying with your data.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it's definitely like a very interesting thing. And it feels like, you know, things are coming to kind of the tipping point where, you know, these things have been going on now for years and years and years. And you know, when it first started, like when companies like Google and Facebook and all these, you know, started doing this, it was kind of seen, I think, by many people as kind of a positive thing. It's like, oh, it's great because, you know, I don't have to pay for this. And, you know, I don't mind if they collect some of my data. I mean, what harm could that be? And I'm seeing more relevant ads. So it kind of looked at something very, very positive. But while now I feel like the things are swinging where people are more starting to see the kind of negative aspects of this and starting to, you know, see things like data leaking into the wrong hands and starting to feel like really uncomfortable about the situation.
Yeah, and without getting too much into political stuff, I'm actually all in favor of people having the option to use their data as payment if they wish. I don't think that's a problem if the person is fine with it. The problem I see is that many companies that do this, they do it in a way that's not very clear to the end user. And that's something even like Steve Jobs mentioned in one of his famous interviews, that when there's privacy involved, you have to be very clear and the user should be able to know exactly what you're collecting and where it's going and have an option to say yes or no. And that's where many companies are not doing it correctly. So they like frame it in a pretty way, but they're actually doing nasty stuff that you know don't know about. For me, that's basically fraud. Like they are trying to persuade you into giving them your data using like benefits that are not necessarily incorrect. You may very well get those benefits, but they are not talking to you about the downsides.
Yeah, exactly. I think one really like clear example of this is when you give a social network your birthday. Like it's pitched to you as like, you know, give us your birthday and we will, you know, show you a nice animation when it's your birthday, or we will tell your friends that it's your birthday so you can get some wishes. But when you are doing that, they also automatically get your age, right? Because you also give them the year you were born. And then, you know, they can start doing all kinds of profiling about that. So yeah, it's definitely a very tricky thing. And like you say, I think also like having some more transparency here would probably be beneficial and would maybe, you know, make people feel a bit better about this stuff. But a very big reason that all of this is happening is also like the rise of machine learning and the fact that, you know, now we have these techniques for, you know, actually being able to derive a lot of, you know, a lot of features based on user data. And here it's something, like you mentioned, where Apple, they've taken a completely different kind of stance and a very different strategy from a lot of other companies. You know, we have Google, we have Facebook, we have all these other companies that are basically feeding their machine learning pipelines server side and kind of, you know, using all the user data they have and, you know, not only from you, but from lots of other users and kind of feeding that into their pipelines. While Apple, they are almost exclusively doing all of their machine learning, as far as we know, client-side, like on the device. So what are your thoughts about that, like about this kind of, you know, usage of machine learning in this way? And what do you think are some of the kind of pros and cons of Apple's approach in this case?
I really like Apple's approach of doing as much as possible locally. They actually do some stuff on the server using the differential privacy stuff they talked about. I think it was like two WWDCs ago.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So they do it in a way that's not like Apple can actually access your data directly. Like they do some aggregation stuff and super like clever very advanced stuff that I don't even understand very well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that that's the right approach. And there are downsides, of course. Like some of their machine learning stuff could be better if they used something like Google and others are doing all on the cloud. But honestly, I think I prefer this way, even if it takes longer for them to catch up with all the other cool stuff that others are doing. I prefer that they do it in a way that preserves my privacy as much as possible.
Yeah, so they've got the differential privacy stuff, but, you know, when I'm setting up a new Apple device, it feels like, you know, Siri has to kind of relearn everything about me. And, you know, all the systems, like, you know, the predictive what apps I might want to use now and all these kind of recommendations, it seems like they need to be kind of, you know, relearned from the beginning. And for me, you know, the convenience part of this is like, it would be very nice if more of this could be shared and if like more of it could be a little bit correlated based on other factors as well that are more like, you know, on the server side, like, you know, where I am and things like that. But of course, yeah, it's a hard balance to strike because, like you say, you don't also want it to be something where it feels like, you know, Apple has all this information about you and they can basically like pinpoint exactly where you are at any given time.
Yeah. And another aspect of this entire Facebook and Cambridge Analytica fiasco is that Mark Zuckerberg was, I think he was invited to speak to Congress in the United States. And I watched a lot of it. And one of the topics that came up, one of the congressmen asked whether Facebook can use your WhatsApp messages to train their models to like give you better recommendations for like ads, basically. And Mark basically said that it's not possible because WhatsApp is end-to-end encrypted, but that's not necessarily true.
How so?
Well, you see, when they talk about end-to-end encryption, what they mean is that once a message leaves your device, it's encrypted, and it's only decrypted when it arrives at the destination, so your friend's device. But that's not talking about the local storage on your device, which is not encrypted.
Yeah, exactly. And you've been looking into this a little bit, and now we're going to put our tinfoil hats a little bit on, because what we're going to speculate about now is not something we have any like evidence about or anything like that. But on iOS, there is this system called app groups, and app groups means that you can put multiple apps into the same group, and they can get a little bit of elevated privileges in terms of what they can do communicating with each other. So for example, for the current client that I work on, we have two apps that we work on, and they share the same app group. And that means that we can, you know, share documents between them, we can have like a shared user defaults container, we can share login credentials using Keychain and things like that. And what you discovered also is that the Facebook suite of apps, which include like Messenger and the Facebook app, Instagram, WhatsApp, they also actually use this app group system.
Yeah, just to be clear, you mentioned tinfoil hats and not having evidence. So just to be clear, like the fact that they share an app group, that's fact. It's real. What we don't have any evidence of is that Facebook, the Facebook app, is actually reading your WhatsApp messages. So that's only theoretical. I didn't find any evidence of it. But they are sharing data. And one of the pieces of data that they share is authentication stuff. So that's fine. That's pretty common for apps of the same company to do. But they do use that container to share like usage data. So what features are you using inside the app and that kind of stuff. So that they are definitely sharing. The local database of WhatsApp, so the little file that contains all of your messages, that file is not stored in the app group. It's stored in WhatsApp's internal storage. But that file could easily be copied by WhatsApp itself to the app group and read by the Facebook app, like super easily. That's definitely possible. But we don't have any evidence that they're actually doing that. But yeah, just because WhatsApp messages are end-to-end encrypted doesn't mean that Facebook can't theoretically read your WhatsApp messages.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And, you know, something we see these companies do from time to time is, you know, they are sometimes, going maybe a little bit further than they should, and they are kind of testing the boundaries. And we're seeing this with, you know, there was stories coming out of Uber and things like that, you know, they were, you know, maybe abusing some of the like location APIs and things like that. And we see kind of these kind of companies, these data-driven companies, that they want as much data as they possibly can get their hands on. So yeah, it's a little bit tinfoil hatty to talk about these things, but it's not something that's like, you know, it could never happen, but it, you know, we haven't seen it happen yet.
And since we're talking about tinfoil hats, no, Facebook is not listening to your microphone. End of story.
That's good to know.
I see so many people believing in that, and that's completely conspiracy theory. I don't know, maybe they did it in the past sometime, but they are definitely not doing that.
And this is something you have tested, or?
Yeah. And it's something that's not possible, because you would need a security vulnerability on iOS to exploit, to be able to record audio in the background without having the red status bar.
Oh, yeah. In the background, definitely. But they could still do it in the foreground, hypothetically, right?
Yeah, they could. But they're not doing it.
Yeah. No, I don't think so either.
But the conspiracy is that they are listening to your microphone all the time, not just when you're using the app.
Right. And the same people who are making those conspiracy theories go out and buy the Amazon Echo and the Google Home and put them in their living rooms. And yeah, there we go. All right, moving on. another thing that I think is important to consider when you're talking about privacy and these kind of things are kind of as developers, how we use these things. So as developers, we have a lot of services that are available to us that are also free, and they have these kind of closed source SDKs that we are expected to put in our app. And we don't need to call out any like specific ones, but you know what we're talking about. There are all these like analytics SDKs, database SDKs, things for tracking crashes and things for distributing betas and things like that. And while again, this is a little bit, you know, putting your tinfoil hat on, I think it's important to remember as developers that these SDKs being free, they also have like a kind of a big incentive to try to look at some of the data you have in your app, and they also get the exact same permissions as your app gets. So if your app can read and write to iCloud, well, the SDK can also read and write to iCloud.
Yeah, exactly. And I know you didn't want to mention specific names, but I need to, because I recently...
You need to get it off your chest.
Yeah, I recently had a big cleanup on Chibi Studio, which we talked about before. I started by removing the Facebook SDK, so that was obvious. And the reason we had it in there is because we ran some Facebook campaigns when the app first launched to get more users. And the only way to track conversions was to add their SDK, which was huge and closed source, and who knows what it was doing.
That's how they get you.
Yeah. So the first thing I did after the Facebook scandal was to remove the Facebook SDK. And I even included that in the release notes, and some people did notice and complimented that we removed that. And so yesterday I was doing some more work on Chibi Studio, and we now don't include any closed source third-party SDKs. So yesterday I removed Fabric, which is a crash reporting and event recording system, which is owned by Google now, by the way. And I removed Flurry, and I even removed Realm, which is not an analytics SDK, and it's fully open source, but I decided to not use it anymore, mainly to save space. And it's very crashy as well, I find it. So now Chibi Studio is free of third-party code, almost. There's just
very nice.
One little thing in there, but I'm going to remove that very soon. So I'm very happy with that. And I have been asked, how are you going to track crashes now? Well, iTunes Connect does that. And yeah, it's a little bit delayed. It's not as nice as Crashlytics. But hey, it's Apple, and it's only for users that allow crash data to be reported. And it's integrated into Xcode. It's not perfect, but in order to get crash reports and get them fixed, it's enough.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good option. And in general, I try to follow the same kind of principle. I want to avoid closed source SDKs as much as possible. It's not so much that I suspect that they will steal all the user data, but it's just like a... it's just like a nice thing to just know what you have in your app. I like to know what code I'm putting in the app and what code is running. And so I love to use open source frameworks and open source SDKs, but when things are closed source and we just get this massive binary, you just put it in, you have no idea what it's doing. And for a lot of these things, you know, I understand why people use them, and there is a big kind of convenience angle to it. But a lot of these things you can actually, if you don't have huge specific requirements, it's a big chance that some of these things you can actually, you know, either write yourself or find some open source version of what you want to do. So usually that's the approach that I take these days. It's like, if all I need to do is simple key value storage, I don't need to include a database SDK. If all I need to do is, you know, beta distributions, well, I can use TestFlight, for example, and I don't need to include an SDK for that. So there's all these kind of different options you could take that don't involve embedding this huge closed source SDK in your app. But I think like a lot of times it comes down to the convenience, and I think taking this like a little bit of extra time to do the research to see, is there something that is open source or comes from Apple or something I could write myself that would actually be a better solution?
Yeah, and many people might be thinking, oh, so that means you don't have analytics anymore for the app. And that's not true, because I wrote my own analytics thing. And I wrote it in a weekend using Vapor. And it runs on a $5 a month DigitalOcean server, and it's fine. It's there, and it's collecting analytics for at least 30,000 monthly active users just fine.
Oh, that's really awesome. Yeah, analytics is, I think, it's a great example, because, you know, most apps that are kind of, you know, more simple, or they don't have these huge needs. Like, they're basically not Google or Facebook. They don't need this huge amount of data to be logged. They're not logging, you know, every single tap the user makes on the screen. I mean, for most apps that I work on, we want to log things like, you know, maybe which screens you go to, or if you do some key user interactions, to be able to tell, you know, how many people did this user interaction after visiting the screen or something like that. And we want to log it in like a completely anonymous way. We just basically want to increment the counter. And implementing that yourself using either, you know, Vapor or something like that, like some cloud service for just storing like simple key value storage, it's not as hard as it sounds.
Yeah, it's definitely not. And it's one of those things, like we talked about Mac apps before and how big companies don't have Mac apps, while single dev shops can make great Mac apps. So that's like a testament for how easy they are to make. And people use this argument that, oh, Mac apps are so hard to make that no one's doing them, but there are like this single person indie apps that are great. And it's the same thing for analytics. Like, oh, I'm not a big company, I can't roll my own. But that's precisely when you actually can, because you're not going to have to handle tens of millions of users. So you can do it with a very cheap server with a simple technology over a weekend, like I did.
Yeah, and you get to write some server-side Swift. How awesome isn't that?
Yeah, and we even have our own iOS app that reports revenue in real time, and it has silent push notifications. Every time someone makes a purchase in the app, it gets a silent push and updates itself. It's great. Like, no third-party service has that, and we do.
There you go. That's awesome.
Yeah, and another benefit of doing your own analytics is that you can do something that's specifically tailored for your app. Like, we have all of these items in the app, and we have a system that's made specifically to register the usage of each item. And that's something that would be hard to do on a separate analytics thing. And every day we get on our Slack a little post from the system telling which was the most used item of the day and some other stats. So that's really cool. And I made it really quickly, and it's very low maintenance.
Nice. It's funny, because now I'm talking to you and hearing this, I'm like, oh, now I also want to write my own analytics framework. And, you know, yesterday we were talking about playgrounds and, you know, how they have become a little bit more unstable recently. And I was like, let me write my own playground system. So it's dangerous for me to talk to you because I just want to create all these things.
Oh, it's dangerous. I give you ideas.
It's perfect. All right. So another really big thing that happened in our industry the last 2 weeks was that you bought a new TV.
Yes. Wow. I think people were waiting for this part of the show where I tell them about my TV.
Are there like reporters waiting outside your house right now, you know, trying to get in and taking a photo of you with your new TV?
There aren't, but probably because it's raining outside. So they didn't come because of that. So the story is I bought myself an Apple TV 4K. And then I decided that I needed a 4K TV to match it. Like, they go well together. So I thought, hey.
It's funny because most people would actually start the other way. They would actually, you know, buy the 4K TV and then be like, oh, maybe I should upgrade my Apple TV. But you buy the Apple product first and then you're like, well, let me upsell myself on like a TV that probably costs like 5 times more than this Apple TV.
Well, actually, the TV was not that expensive. I was thinking for a long time about getting an OLED TV, and that one would be really expensive. So I decided not to go that way. OLED TVs are kind of new, and they are still very expensive. So I got myself a quote-unquote cheap TV, which is just a normal LED TV, and it's 4K HDR, and it's a really nice one. I don't think it's of much use for me to say the specific model here, because these models are not global. They change based on country, but the one I got was a Samsung one, and it's one of the like baseline 4K TVs, and I watched some reviews of it before making the purchase. I'm that kind of person. I watch reviews before purchasing something. And like the points that the people in those reviews mentioned as like cons of this model were like the things I liked the most. Like, oh, the TV is not like very pretty. It's not like black piano or something. It's just a matte black bezel. Okay, that's awesome. I want that. And oh, the remote control has very few buttons. Awesome. I like that. So yes, like the cons are like my pros, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, who wants a remote with like a lot of buttons? That sounds, you know, that's just confusing.
Yeah, especially since I'm using the Apple TV most of the time, so I just use that remote.
Yeah.
So yeah, so one of the main things that made me want to buy the new Apple TV 4K, I've had an Apple TV before, but I didn't bring it together when I moved, so it's back home. And I liked it, but I didn't have two things that make a big difference, for me at least, with the Apple TV experience, which are the AirPods and HomePod. And those two are like a huge advantage if you have the Apple TV, because you can watch stuff and have the audio come through AirPods, which is great if you don't want to disturb other people. And or if you just want like to use headphones, I really like using headphones. And you can use HomePod as the TV speaker, which is really cool.
And is that something that works for everything, or is it only like it's AirPlay, right? So it needs to AirPlay the audio to the HomePod.
Yeah, it's kind of tricky. It doesn't work for stuff like games. So the audio is not in sync if you play games that way. But from my experience, it works perfectly with like YouTube and Netflix and iTunes movies. So that's the main use case. the first thing I did when I got everything installed was to watch one of the Stranger Things episodes with the audio coming through HomePod and the nice 4K HDR, and it's awesome. It's really nice, a really nice experience. And I don't know what kind of magic it does, but it I think it like delays the picture so it matches up with the sound.
Yeah, it probably buffers up like enough content to, you know, take into account that delay. Because I think this is still AirPlay 1, right? AirPlay 2 is not out yet. And AirPlay 1 has like a fixed delay. I think it's 2 seconds or something.
Yeah, 2 seconds.
So they can just offset the picture, I guess, to take that into account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it works surprisingly well. And I tried something that I really thought it wouldn't work, and it did, and it surprised me. One of the stuff I wanted to watch doesn't have an Apple TV app, so I AirPlayed from my iPad to the Apple TV with the audio coming from the Apple TV to HomePod. So I was AirPlaying from iPad to TV, from TV to HomePod, and it worked.
Nice, 2 degrees of AirPlay.
Yeah,
I love it. That's awesome.
that was like, oh, there's no way this is going to work, and it did.
Nice. Yeah, AirPlay, we were talking earlier about like Apple Pay and how it's like this magical futuristic thing. Whenever AirPlay works, it's the same for me. It's like when you have people over, for example, and you want to watch a YouTube video and you just like AirPlay it, it almost feels like in these science fiction movies when they just like flick the content onto like a projector or something. And yeah, it's really, really nice. And it's really cool to see this like ecosystem now being built up around AirPlay where, you know, especially now when we're going to get AirPlay 2 at some point in the future, to see like the HomePod and all these things kind of talking to each other in a very nice way. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, and the Apple TV experience is really nice. So if you're thinking about it and you're not very sure, I can definitely say that it's a very nice product. And one of the areas that Apple has really improved recently is initial setup for any Apple product if you already own at least one Apple product. So you fire up your Apple TV and it's in the setup mode, and you get your iPhone nearby and you set up like really quickly. I think I only had to type my password once and it was in the iPhone, and it synced everything and even installed some of the apps that have Apple TV apps. And like I had my Apple TV ready with all of my content and my accounts in like 3 minutes.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's. I'm really, really happy that that's finally happening, because we talked about earlier how we wish that some of the machine learning stuff and some of the things that Siri learns about you could be, you know, synced between devices. But the fact that you can just like transfer like the first time setup like that is something, you know, Apple can do because they own all of the different devices that are involved. And the fact that they're now doing that, I think it's really great. And I also love the UI where you just, you know, you bring the phone close to the other one. Like when I got my iPhone 10, that's what I did with the iPhone 7, just like transferred all the information over. And it's really cool. It's another one of those like sci-fi moments, I think. So yeah, overall, you're happy with the new 4K Apple TV?
Yeah, I'm very happy, and I'm probably going to play around with developing something for it, of course.
You mean you're actually going to spelunk this thing?
Probably.
I wouldn't count on anything else. Awesome. I'm sure we're going to check in on your 4K adventures later on as well. That's all the topics that we had for this episode. We're going to be back in 2 weeks with some new topics and some new fun things to talk about. If you want to get in touch with us, you can go to stacktracepodcast.fm, where there's links to our Twitter and there's links to sending us emails if you want to do that. You can also follow us on Twitter at stacktracepod. You can also follow us. Guy is at _inside and I am at John Sundell. You can also find Guy's fine writing over at 9to5mac.com. And you can find me at swiftbysundell.com. But that's it for now. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.